Well, I don't know about you, but I've had it with the city. I'm going to sell the house, move to the country, and get a few acres. Maybe plant some seeds, grow a few crops, and live happily ever after. But wait, how do I start a farm, and how do I make it pay?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 720th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down way over there in Tokyo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Folks, given the stress of city living, it's a dream I'm certain we have all shared somewhere along the line. We quit our city job, sell the house, and move to a small farm out in the country. We'll plant a few seeds, grow a few crops, and then live a happy, stress-filled life with long, lingering evenings of sitting on the front porch with a bottle of fine Cabernet. But then, in the middle of this fine dream, a question nags its way into our consciousness, and that question, of course, is always the same one, which is, how do we start a farm, and how do we make it pay? Well, here to help us wake up today from our dream, we have Kurt Timmermeister, who is the author of Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Welcome to the Food Chain, Kurt.
Thank you.
Up there in Vashon Island, Washington, correct?
I am, and I sound like I have better weather than you do down there today.
Yeah, well, I think we got your weather today. But you have Kurt Wood Farms, Vashon Island, Washington, a proprietor, and you're an actual farmer. Make your living on the land these days, right?
I seem to be. Last time I checked, it's still working. Yeah.
Good for you. Well, you know, in thinking about what to title your segment on the Food Chain, I decided to call it Out of the Frying Pan. Would that be appropriate, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a challenging little idea to leave the city and to start a farm, no question.
Well, I'd like to talk about, before we get going on your farm, I'd like to talk to you about your job in the city, because there's something in your job in the city that, to me, indicated the possibility that you could actually become a farmer. Tell us how you got started in the restaurant business.
I mean, at the very beginning, I was in school in Paris at the American College, and I had to do a work-study internship. And it was expected that I would go work at the UN in Paris, or, you know, Citicorp Paris, or IBM, or something like that. That's what they would usually do. I wanted to work in a bakery. So that's how I got started. They found an internship for me at this beautiful, beautiful bakery near the American College. And I came to love food, certainly living in Paris gave me that sense of food is important, especially finding it daily and finding high quality things in the market, and really appreciating something I'd never seen in Seattle at that point.
So at the age of 24, you started your own restaurant?
24, I opened this little coffee shop and bakery, and tiny, tiny thing, 200 square feet, five tables, and it took off. It did very, very well. It was the beginning of espresso in Seattle. Probably the beginning of espresso in the whole country, for that matter.
Why did it take off, Kurt?
I made great pastries. I think that was part of it. Right place, right time was a lot of it. Howard Schultz had just bought Starbucks and had just started that going. And people really wanted something very kind of homemade and close to the producer.
And you were very close.
I think it hit a nerve.
Yeah, and you were very close, weren't you?
I was a very small place, so I would bake the pastries and hand them to people in this tiny, tiny kitchen.
Kind of right out of the oven, right onto the plate, right to the customer?
Absolutely, it was perfect.
Uh-huh. And at the age of 24, and you find yourself with a restaurant that's taking off. That must have been a wonderful feeling.
It didn't take off immediately, so there was some there was some point there at the beginning where I was a little nervous. But then it just kind of did well, and it was very exciting, and I loved what I was doing, so I just kept at it, kept making more pastries and more coffee, and we added a little bit of lunch and then a little bit of dinner, and then I opened a second one, a larger one down the street.
And away you go. So you find yourself with some bucks in your pocket, and And so you've been living in a little studio apartment, working really hard, and it's time to get a home, right?
Yeah, right. And for some reason that I'm still trying to remember to this day, I chose to find a piece of land on Vashon Island, just off of Seattle, off of West Seattle, accessed only by ferry boats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a strange anomaly of a place where Seattle's very developed and there's lots of sprawl around it and so on. And then there's this strange little island that sits right next to it between Seattle and Tacoma that's rather underpopulated. It's rather beautiful. It's not, I don't know if rural is really the word for it anymore. It's more kind of sparsely populated suburbia, kind of.
So it's,
and that's where I bought a piece of property.
It's kind of country right in the middle of the metropolitan area, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's great. And the boat ride is, 15 or 20 minutes. It's not too long.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very tedious to get to the ferry dock and to wait for the boat and pay for the boat and then head into the city. And it discourages a lot of people from living here.
So tell us about your land. You bought a four acre parcel of land?
The original piece was 4 acres, and it was really trashed. I mean, it had been rented out for many, many years, covered in blackberries, lots of old cars, old tractors, strange little sheds that were kind of hacked together piecemeal, and then this chicken coop that had been built in the 30s for 4 chickens, and then it'd be remodeled in the 60s, and that was the house. And I lived in it for, 10 years probably. And looking back, I'm looking at it now, where it was, and I'm just like, what was I thinking? It very low ceilings, looked like a chicken coop, and it didn't have a great foundation and so on.
So
isn't
the entire Pacific Northwest covered in blackberry brambles?
It is, yeah, right. I actually, in the writing of this book, I had, three words about it. Oh, it was covered with blackberries. My editor in New York was like, didn't really know what a blackberry was and didn't really know what they look like and didn't understand that they covered everything. They grow incredibly well here. They're not native hybrids that were brought in by Luther Burbank. And they grow incessantly. They never stop. They don't die back in the winter. So if you don't maintain a piece of property, they'll just be covered in these blackberries. And they'll go up 20-foot trees. They'll just go everywhere. The berries are very tasty, though. That's the good part.
They have a little sweetness to them. But you have a piece of property and overwhelmed by blackberries. How did you go about, here you are, a restaurateur in the city, coming home to your home in the country from across the ferry, and here you have a piece of property overwhelmed by blackberries. How did you manage, how did you deal with all of those thorny vines?
As an indication of how little I knew, I'd grown up in the city and I really knew nothing at all. I mean, we had a little yard behind the house, that was about it growing up. I originally thought I could just kind of use pruning shears or something. And I would try that for the first year or something. And then I tried a little, push mower. And that was equally silly. Someone then gave me a riding mower and I tried cutting them down with that. And then I started to get a little bit of traction with that. And I thought that would do it, that I could really maintain or kind of rescue 4 acres with a riding lawnmower. Really, thinking about it now, it's insane. Eventually, now I have a much larger tractor. And for a while there, I was hiring heavy equipment. And that took probably 10 years to understand that a large Traco or a large tractor or something could clear an acre in, 2 hours, what I had been spending 2 or 3 years trying to clear. And I didn't even know what a Traco was at the time. I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
And so, very gradually, but surely, a city boy falls in love with farm equipment, right?
To this day, I love farm equipment. I mean, tractors are probably one of my favorite things of all. I have to keep myself from just endlessly, picking up more of them on Craigslist or going to the John Deere dealer or something. If I had a large, warehouse building here that I could dry, it would be filled for sure. There was one of the most amazing machines ever made, I think.
Well, as an observer and writer, what the heck is it about tractors and men?
I think it's just that they're so obvious. Nothing's hidden. So there's the engine, there are the tires, there's the wheels. It's just right in front of you, and there's something kind of kind of brute about it, you know, testosterone laced, where it's not, nothing's hidden, it's not made fancy. It's just, it's very blunt, and I find them gorgeous.
And it's only designed for one thing, which is to do work. That's it.
Right. Yeah.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're quitting our jobs in the city. We're moving to the country. We're going to set up a farm and live happily ever after on Kurt's front porch with a bottle of fine Cabernet. This is The Food Chain, and we are with Kurt Timmermeister, author of Growing a Farmer, the story of how he became a farmer, jumped out of the frying pan of a restaurateur and into the fire of being a farmer on Vashon Island in Washington. What can we learn from Kurt's experience? What do you think? You're free to join us today with your questions. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Kurt Timmermeister and you right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, what does it take to quit our job in the city and sell our house, move to the country, get a few acres, and start a farm and make it work? Well, I think I picked up one tip from Kurt Timmermeister, who is the author of Growing a Farmer already. And, Kurt, can you guess what my first tip would be from you already?
I'm guessing it's, you know, go for the biggest possible piece of equipment.
No, it wasn't. It was from your experience of starting a restaurant at the age of 24. What I hear here is that you are an entrepreneur from the start, from the get-go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Where did you get that?
I'm not sure. It's certainly just absolutely who I am, without question.
Mm-hmm.
It's how I think of everything. I'm always trying to find a way to make something work. That way I'm not one to rely on a boss or a job or something. I must say it would be extraordinarily difficult to run your own farm if you didn't have that kind of entrepreneurial spirit.
Which is, you're a gambler at heart, right?
Absolutely. And sometimes I win and sometimes I lose, yeah.
And the other thing about being an entrepreneur is that I think that I hear from you is that it takes a lot of hard work. I mean, not just in farming, but you're a hard worker to get from the get-go.
I work a lot. I mean, restaurants are extraordinary amount of work. So I grew up working in restaurants, and then I had my own for 18 years. So running a farm 7 days a week doesn't seem really unusual. Maybe if I'd come from, you know, a cushier job, maybe it would have seemed like a little bit more work, but I'm certainly used to it.
Be a tough world for one who is used to pushing paper from one side of the desk to the other, to go from that to a four-acre parcel of bramble-filled trouble, right? How do you deal with that? And it would be a whole different thing. But for somebody who is used to working and used to making educated guesses on what's going to happen in the future, maybe not so much so. But lead us through the transition, because here you are, a restaurateur, a successful restaurateur in Seattle. You've got a small parcel of land, a ferry ride away on Vashon Island. Wow. What made you make the leap to give up that successful life of a restaurateur for the bramble-filled existence of a beginning farmer?
A couple of things. One of which I had this kind of food epiphany, if you will. I had a little coffee shop first, then I had a larger one, and then eventually I had, for the last decade, a rather large full-service restaurant that ran every single day of the year oftentimes included Christmas, breakfast, lunch, dinner. We sold a lot of food. And
wouldn't that make you a foodie in itself, though?
No, because it wasn't. I wasn't running Chez Panisse, 7 days a week. It was in the middle market, and it was. It was very good food, but it wasn't extraordinary food, quality-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I suddenly started looking at these cases and cases and cases of food coming in, especially meats. Meats were the greatest challenge. And I'd been seeing these things my whole life, and you just kind of get used to it. And then little by little, I just couldn't look at it anymore. And it just, when you see, 20 cases of chickens or something, it just doesn't, it's hard to get excited about them. It's different than coming in the front door of the restaurant and just getting a lovely plate of chicken. When you see cases of it every day, and it just kind of ruins it. It ruined it for me, for sure. And I stopped eating in my restaurant is what happened.
What?
Little by little.
You stopped eating in your own restaurant?
I stopped eating certain things. I couldn't eat chicken. Couldn't eat pork there at the end. The beef, the beef didn't bother me. I like beef more. Maybe that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, I have this piece of land that's in better and better shape as we're going along. And I started raising food there. And just small amounts, sheep at first and a few pigs and so on and some chickens. And the contrast was extraordinary, where here are these chickens in the restaurant that I just couldn't look at, and here is this chicken that I'm raising that is exceptionally tasty.
That's
what pushed me.
I like the story of coming back from a restaurant filled with food to your little piece of property and digging up a crooked old carrot. And there it was. It was your crooked old carrot, right?
Absolutely. Part of all of that for anyone in this situation is simply the fact that you grew it, or you picked it, or you harvested it, or something makes it really special and exciting. At least at the beginning. And also the quality can be exceptional, and it's both of those things. I certainly have gotten excited about something I raised that really wasn't necessarily high quality, but I made it. It was really exciting. But most of the time, the quality is also there as well.
So, the epiphany. Tell us about the actual coming to realization that you had something there, whereas you were losing something with your success in the city.
I think it was a long process, and it overlapped, and it was just, it's one of those things where I wish I could say that, on, October 6th at noon, I suddenly, it all made sense. When in fact it's more like, a year later, you're like, oh my gosh, now I understand what I've been noticing. And it took me a long time to connect all the dots of like, here's this beautiful leg of lamb that's on the barbecue that's super tasty, that are from these lambs that I had. Oh, and now I don't really feel like driving to work tomorrow and working in the walk-in and putting away all this food. And suddenly, you've been doing this for week after week after week, and then suddenly, which isn't really suddenly, you go, oh, I can grow great food. I should be on my farm more and more. And I also liked being on this farm. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. So,
mm-hmm.
The more years I was here, the more work that was done, the more comfortable it was.
But you have this, but you have this wonderful success of this big restaurant that you've just opened, and people admiring you. Like, hey, here's somebody that's actually doing it, and yet it takes a lot to turn away from that, doesn't it? From the source.
Well, your first comment about the entrepreneur. The other kind of part of the character of someone who's an entrepreneur is that it's the challenge that's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
The maintenance is not very exciting, at least in my case. I think with most people, such as myself, opening a restaurant is really exciting. Getting it all to work, getting it to be profitable and so on is such an exciting challenge. Running it day after day is not quite as much of a challenge. So I was ripe to be moving on after 10 years of this last one. For sure.
So you sold your restaurant and made the leap?
I did. Haven't looked back.
And haven't looked back. So what was it like that first day when you were no longer encumbered by your success in the city and you faced the prospect of having two hands in a parcel of land, and what the heck do I do now?
I put some thought into it for sure, and I had a few things going. I still, at that point, I was still trying to raise apple trees for hard cider, which was probably one of the bigger disasters I've had. I also thought I would raise animals, so I had pigs going, and I had sheep going, and so on, chickens. And then I started a vegetable business, selling farmer's market, CSA, inside a farm stand, and that's what I put most of my effort into immediately, and that's what we went on. I took on a partner who helped me get that started, and we started growing a lot of vegetables. And then it got a little more complicated after that.
Mm-hmm. But your first commercial enterprise then was the vegetables?
Vegetables, yeah.
Okay, and which, of course, leads to a very interesting story, right? Well, you got to hold that interesting story for when we come back, because we're going to have to take a quick break. But today, folks, we're talking about making the break from our city life and buying a farm out in the country, a little small parcel of land, and making a go of it. And what does it take? And the first thing we learned, of course, is that you have to have some entrepreneur in you. No entrepreneur, you're going to have a tough time facing all the challenges. And speaking of challenges, that might be the second thing that we have on our list. You have to love challenges and hate boredom, because that's part of what exists from leaving the frying pan and falling into the fire of being a farmer. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Kurt Timmermeister, author of Growing a Farmer, a real fun read. Pick it up and you'll enjoy it. It's a story of how he became a farmer, turned in his restaurants and became a farmer. We will be right back for his adventures in trying to grow vegetables. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're moving to the country, leaving our city life behind. We're chucking our success and taking the big gamble of moving into a small parcel of land and going to make a go of it as a farmer with the guy who did just that, the author of Growing a Farmer, Kurt Timmermeister. We're following his success as he moved from being a restaurateur in Seattle to a small parcel of land on Vashon Island, a short ferry ride away, but really worlds away from the metropolitan area that surrounds it. And there are a lot of little places like that in the Seattle metropolitan area. Are there not, Kurt? A lot of little places that are kind of like you?
Similar. I mean, Vashon is unique in how close it is and how underpopulated it is. But there's a series of islands that run from Tacoma all the way up to Canada. And all of them are difficult to get to. And they all have great little kind of rural areas to them. And those are really beautiful.
Let's talk a little bit about your commercial crops when you first started to get the notion that maybe I could grow some things and sell them. What did you first start out doing?
Probably the first one was the greatest disaster, which was I planted apple trees, old French and English cider varieties, because I was going to make hard cider, which I thought was brilliant. I thought this was just great, and I planted 150 trees, which is a fair amount of trees to plant by hand, and I had put a lot of thought into the business part of it and what it would taste like and how I could market it and how it would be made and so on. I didn't put enough thought into how they would be grown. So I planted the trees and in probably April or so, about this time of year, and they started to bud out and leaf out in May and June. And then I went up one day to check on them, and they were essentially destroyed by the deer.
Deer.
In one night, they could just, a small little pack of deer comes through, and they just nibble these things to nothing in one night.
Deer delights.
Oh, my gosh. I just devastated them. And I didn't even really understand. I mean, it just seemed so, it just gives you that horrible feeling in your stomach that you've just lost everything, like in hours. And so I replanted them the next year, the ones that had been totally destroyed. And I tried a series of strange little fences and, motion sensors and sprays. And I just kept throwing money at it for way too long. And I have to admit that ripped them all out. There were a few sticks still left. Probably 10 of the trees of the 150 were still kind of looked like an actual apple tree, and they were just cut down.
I fought the deer, and the deer won.
The deer won, yes, without question. Later on, my cows kind of contributed to it as well.
Uh-huh.
I found that the cows were rather fond of the trees, and so they took the last few branches down.
So from hard cider, you went where?
Then we did the vegetables. We did mm-hmm. vegetables for market. And very standard kind of small farm vegetable growing, you know, carrots and broccoli and salad and potatoes and onions and that kind of
mm-hmm.
thing. That's a tremendous challenge. I have the most respect for any market farmer who can do it and do it profitably. I did not. The land here was not of high enough quality, which I didn't really understand. I don't like vegetables enough, so I wasn't really excited about it. Apple cider, I was excited about. pork, I'm excited about. Now cheese, I'm very excited about. But vegetables, the amount of time and kind of energy that it takes, you have to really love it. And that's what I'm thinking of now. Like, I mean, if I liked the vegetables more, I would have concentrated on it a little more. But it's a phenomenally difficult way to make a living.
What happened to you?
It was more that it just wasn't penciling out. We just couldn't grow enough vegetables to cover the cost. And I had had, by that point, 3 restaurants, and I just knew, like, in my gut what a good business feels like. You know when there's enough coming in, enough money coming in to pay off your expenses. And we would sell vegetables at the market, you know, maybe a big day would be, you know, $400 or something. I just knew leaving that market at the end of the day that, God, it probably cost me $375 to grow those. I mean, it just didn't make sense at all.
Right.
And to this day, I'm not really sure how people do it successfully.
Was it easy to back out?
Yeah, pretty much. I had a few things to kind of ease out of. I still grow a lot of vegetables for myself and for the people that work for me and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we always grow things here. But growing lots of things for the market, farm stand stuff, that's pretty easy to shut off without question.
So from vegetables, you turn to animals, animal husbandry. That must have been a leap.
I did. I had been growing a few animals over the years. I didn't realize it, but I was kind of trying out different animals and seeing what suited me best. There is this kind of classic progression, and I see it with people who move here all the time. It's probably the same down in California where someone buys a few acres, and they do this kind of old McDonald's farm thing where they get 2 sheep, 2 pigs, you know, 1 cow, a dozen chickens, you know, 2 goats, and they grow vegetables and they grow fruit trees and so on, and they want this very complete old McDonald's farm.
Right.
And then little by little they start getting rid of something.
What goes first?
For me it was goats. Me and goats did not get along at all.
The great marauders.
Oh my gosh, they just destroy things and they're loud. People love them, but I'm not one of their great fans. They didn't even last a year. I mean, they were in and out pretty quickly. Sheep lasted some time because I still like roast leg of lamb. There's nothing better for that. But I don't have enough land. I have 13 acres now. I just didn't have enough grass to feed them. So bringing in hay for sheep for meat just doesn't pencil out at all. So they left as well.
How long did they last?
Oh, they lasted 10 years from it.
Oh, okay.
I kept them for a long time.
So they were around for a while then.
They did. They had some good staying power.
Now, were you trying to make money with them?
Sort of. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of hoped they would, but it just, again, like the vegetables, it was just like, this is not working. I had to sell this land for $1,000, you know. Then there was pigs. I mean, pigs I started breeding at the beginning, where I would get a sow and I'd get a boar and breed them, and I'd have a bunch of baby pigs, and I'd sell off some and I'd raise them. And that's been a bridge now. I still have hogs. But I get them this year's in about another week. I buy them from another farmer when they're weaned and 2 months old.
Mm-hmm.
I raise them through the summer, slaughter them at the end of the fall, and then where there's no pigs here, you know, December, January, February, March.
I'd like to pick up our conversation about pigs because they always have been kind of like the ultimate farm animal for a very simple reason. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're moving to the farm, a little parcel of land outside of the city. We're going to set up a farm and we're going to make some money somehow. And that's what we're learning from Kurt Timmermeister, who is the author of Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Way up there in Vashon Island, Washington. But it can kind of apply just about anywhere. So do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, what is it about pigs that make them the perfect farm animal? Let's ask Kurt Timmermeister, who is the author of Growing a Farmer, and one who probably has learned what makes them so perfect. Kurt, what is it about pigs?
Pigs are great. Like, no question. I make cheese here is what I do now, mm-hmm. farmstead cheese. So there's always byproducts from that, mostly whey, which is large gallons of this kind of high-protein drink that's left over from cheese making. And we grow lots of vegetables and fruits and so on. And there's always extra stuff or rotted stuff or not good stuff. And it goes to the pigs. And all that waste ends up being bacon 8 months later. And it's a great little system. We do compost manure and straw from the barn here, but most everything else, instead of going to a compost, goes to the hogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't keep that many. I might keep, you know, 3, 4, 5 a year. But we can keep them fed, you know, from extra food, and they recycle it beautifully, and they're great animals. I really like them. And we all love bacon and pork chops.
Don't we all? And really, that's what makes the pig almost the ubiquitous farm animal around the world, right?
Absolutely. And I could give you some fancy, you know, they convert protein to meat, you know, better than anyone else or something. But that's essentially they don't get sick, you know, they don't really have problems. When you're breeding them, they produce a lot of offspring, which as cows have one a year. Hogs could have 2 litters conceivably if it's really well done, and each one could be, you know, 10 or 12 each. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's the reason why pork is cheap.
Yes.
It's the reason why there's a lot of pork out there.
It's also the reason why wild pigs are overrunning Texas.
Wow.
And, well, you know, they're also very smart, aren't they?
They really are. It's funny, I often hear that. They definitely are smart. They're not, you know, your brother Larry. They're not, you know, brilliant, and they're not even as smart as my dog. Compared to a sheep, absolutely. You know, or a chicken,
mm-hmm.
Definitely. But by smart, we it's incremental for sure.
Tell us about your escape artist boar.
I did have a lovely boar. This is when I was breeding hogs, and he was huge, junior, and they definitely are smart enough on this level. He would sneak out. Just after being fed in the morning, he would go to the neighbors. He'd have to cross a couple of my fences. And then there must have been apple trees over there or something he wanted, but he would hang out there all day and then sneak back through the fences by the time I came out to feed him in the evening. And I was not the wiser to this at all. My neighbors, however, did notice that they had, you know, 300-400-pound hog in their pasture every day. They weren't quite as thrilled.
I guess not.
It was kind of amusing.
I guess not. So, and from those farm animals, you finally bought a cow.
I did.
Cow.
And it was actually when I was growing vegetables. And I just had this gut sense that financially this was not working, the vegetables. So I had to find a way to have more sales. And I had a farm stand, you know, and I was delivering vegetables to the market. So if I could just sell a little more, it wouldn't cost me that much. To sell more to these customers that wanted things. So raw milk was what I thought was possible. So I got a cow, a single Jersey cow. Her name was Dinah. And I brought her on and started milking her and started selling the raw milk.
I detect the third thing in becoming a successful farmer, the third personal characteristic. Can you guess what that was?
Or insane?
Perseverant.
Uh, I'm extremely stubborn, and I don't like to fail. I don't like to quit. And I was committed to making this work without question. It's the way I kept restaurants going. I would just the restaurant that I would open on the first day was not necessarily what the restaurant looked like when it was successful, you know, 6 months or a year or 2 years later. I just kept trying things until I found out what the market wanted, you know, what I was capable of, and so on. And I did the same thing with this farm until I found really what would work, and then I did it very well.
So you have an idea of what will work, and of course, rarely is that what you know eventually transpires. It always it's always a process of working through things until you find that which really works. And
right.
To do that, you have to be very perseverant, because if it doesn't work at the outset, it probably isn't going to work at the outset. If you're not perseverant, you won't be able to hang around and find out what's going to work.
Right, so, and I think it's hard to even know that. I think it's, you know, the climate, the soil you have, your skills, what people want. I mean, it's all those things are involved. And it may be very difficult to figure that out beforehand, I think.
Yes, Dine of the Cow. You went into raw milk. That must have been interesting.
I did. I probably one of the, you know, not the stupidest things I've ever done, but I sold it originally without a license, which was really foolish in on a business model. I mean, it, people loved it. Thankfully, it was safe and healthy, but it, there was certainly the opportunity for it not to be safe and healthy.
So
and I wasn't really aware of that.
Essentially, you were selling fresh milk right out of the cow.
Right out of the cow. In glass mason jars, in the farm stand. The state of Washington would have been most upset if they had known about it. I did, after a few months of that, I decided to get a grade A license from the State Department of Agriculture, which was a tremendous improvement for my well-being, I think.
Okay, good. And then from that raw milk, kind of got, that didn't quite work either, but you finally found something that did work, and that's what we're going to pick up when we come back. After so many attempts and so many different things that didn't work, we find something that does work. What is it? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about becoming a farmer with the man himself, Kurt Timmermeister, author of Growing a Farmer. What was it that he found that finally worked? Do stay tuned. We will be right back with some success. Well, folks, to make the move from the city to the country, we certainly must be entrepreneurial. We have to be a gambler. We have to be willing to risk our time and our treasures on a proposition that may or may not work. We also have to love challenge, because Lordy knows being on a farm is a challenge. It's probably a new challenge to boot every day. And we have to be perseverant. We have to be willing to hang in there, because that's certainly going to be an important part of the equation. But what is what I think is the most important thing? Let's see if we can figure that out with Kurt Timmermeister. Kurt, you finally hit on something that worked, and it was, what was it?
Farmstead cheese is what I make now. I make like a Camembert cheese, Blooming Rind cheese, mm-hmm. From Jersey cow milk. I have 16 Jersey cows on this land.
Wow.
Twice a day, and make beautiful cheese.
And you named it after your first cow, right?
It's called Dinah's Cheese. It's named after her, for sure.
And and I guess when you think about it, you know, farmstead cheese is probably the ultimate process product. You know, so it's a distillation of everything that you do. Why did that work where the other things didn't work?
I would say that besides the fact that I love cheese, I love making cheese, and I'm good at it. Those have to work as well. Is that I can adjust the price. That's probably the most important part of it. If I'm selling carrots, I have to compete with a lot of different people growing carrots, almost all of whom are more efficient than I am. You're competing with very large, you know, like Earthbound Farms, say, in California, or even just, you know, big farms here in Washington. So you can't really adjust the price to your costs. With the cheese, there's certainly Camembert, you know, made in this country, not very many, and certainly I can price them accordingly. If my costs are very high, I can make an expensive cheat and cover my costs. I don't produce so many that it would even really matter. The people who want the cheese are willing to pay for it, and they're willing to pay the real cost of it. And that's what's unique to a product such as cheese.
So having your name on it really is everything, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's people aren't just buying a carrot. They're buying this cheese from this farm, made by this person, you know, from the milk of these cows. And people very much want that, and I'm glad they do. It's an excellent cheese.
So it's really food with his farmer's face on it, then. That's Kurt Timmermeister's cheese, made from his Dyna cows. And I know where Kurt is, and he's on Vashon Island, and it's a beautiful place, and the cheese is beautiful. So there's that connection there. But what is it? What would you say would be the most important ingredient to becoming a farmer?
Boy, I think all of those. I mean, you've certainly listened to them. I mean, you have to be really, really wanted and have to be very patient and full of optimism. Mm-hmm. That's I think, the most important.
You know, I think it is. I think the most important thing is I think you just have to be intelligent. I really do think that. I think that you really have to be smart to judge all of the things that you must judge. And I guess you must be smart, Kurt, because you pulled it off. And we thank you for joining us on The Food Chain today. The folks, the book right here in my hands, Growing a Farmer, How I Learned to Live Off the Land. Fun read, fun story, lots of adventures in farming with Kurt Timmermeister. Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.